Welcome to Buddha at the Gas Pump. My name is Rick Archer. Buddha at the Gas Pump is an ongoing series of conversations with spiritually awakening people. We've done over 700 of them now. And if this is new to you and you'd like to check out previous ones, please go to batgap.com and look under the interviews menu, where you'll see them organized in several different ways. This program is made possible through the support of appreciative listeners and viewers. So if you appreciate it and would like to help support it, there are PayPal buttons on every page of the website and a donations page that explains more. And also we have a nice team of volunteers that helps with some different things such as proofreading transcripts and so on. So if you'd like to help with those kinds of things, get in touch. My guest today is Josh Jost. Josh started out in a family of strict religious Mennonite people, and he later led a healing movement during his youth, and he was the healer. Some miraculous stories around that. He eventually got married, experienced financial hardship, living in drug-filled slums in Scotland, I believe it was, cleaning toilets in a factory. Eventually became an advisor to heads of Fortune 500 companies and billionaires, and is currently working with one of the world's most renowned private islands. Josh's journey has been unusual, to say the least. Fueled by his yearning for awakening, his story is about embracing disillusionment as the path to enlightenment. So he lives in Tahiti, which is why we got our time zones mixed up. I was presuming that was way out in the Western Pacific, but it's actually slightly east of Hawaii, but it's in the Southern Hemisphere, and so you're heading into winter, so it's all very confusing. But you don't have winter in Tahiti, I'm sure. So you live there with your wife and youngest son. And we're going to start out, I guess, talking about your Mennonite upbringing and the topic of disillusionment, of which you said you had three major ones. And I always regard that word as having a positive connotation, because if not being enlightened is being in a state of illusion, then we want to get disillusioned, right?
Yeah, I agree with you. And thanks, by the way, Rick, for inviting me on the show this morning. It's a pleasure to speak. Yeah, so I think that disillusionment, I think, is something that when you're kind of early in the journey of enlightenment, I think it's a very terrifying thing. When you're invested in your illusion, in the illusory world, and you start to see some cracks in the matrix, so to speak, then I think that's really scary. I think as you progress, it becomes something that you learn to embrace and almost enjoy as a part of, like, okay, there's another part of me that I can let go, or another part of my illusion that I can let go. And I know that there's a greater reality that I'm discovering beyond it. So I have come to see it as a positive word, but I don't think it's viewed that way, I would say, in the mainstream.
Yeah. I'm reminded of that Queen song, "Another One Bites the Dust," as we shed our illusions.
Seems to be a lot of that going on right now.
Yeah. So, considering that we're going to have a conversation about your profound spiritual awakening, which would resonate very much with Eastern spirituality, the fact that you started out in a strict Mennonite family necessitates your having gone through some major shifts in perspective, hence some disillusionments.
Yeah, indeed. Yes, I was born in Kansas in a small Mennonite community. There's sort of a spectrum within the Mennonite world of those that are very ultra traditional and those that are still quite traditional, but not quite to the sort of ultra scale. So some of them look just like the Amish in terms of how they live and practice and live as when they came to the New World, a couple hundred years ago. Others have become a little bit more modern. We've got cars and technology and so forth, but it still have a very conservative viewpoint of the world. So we were a little bit more in the less ultra side of things. And that happened to do with my dad decided when he was young that he was going to become an airline pilot. And, my grandfather told him there's no way you're going to fly one of those contraptions, but he would sneak off before Sunday school and Sunday mornings and get flying lessons and eventually worked his way into a flying career. So, I had this very strange contrast between living in a community that was very conservative. We, had a lot of cousins that dressed like they were off the set of Little House on the Prairie, and being in that sort of community space, and then my dad taking me away on trips and then visiting London and Paris when I was a kid and parts of the U.S. and having your eyes open to the way the rest of the world was. So it was an interesting dichotomy to grow up in. I was very interested in spirituality and purpose and so forth from a young age. As a matter of fact, I even had at one point, this is when we had moved away, we were living in California. I had a picture story Bibles, like a comic book version of the Bible for kids. And I would take that in my, I had a little red wagon and I put it in my wagon. I'd go around the door to door telling people about the Bible because I was just so fascinated with all these stories. You know, I kind of, I guess, was always the good kid and sort of did things the way that I was told growing up and, you know, did what I was supposed to. And then I think my first stage of disillusionment happened when I was in high school because I went to, of course, a Mennonite high school. This one was in a community in California. And I was doing all the right things. And inside, I just felt so unhappy. I felt really miserable. You know, I was looking around at all my Christian friends and, you know, I kind of thought, you know, I think we're all in the same place here. We're told that we have the life. We've got the truth. It's all heaven and joy and all that sort of stuff. But I didn't feel like any of us were actually living that. So I just came to sort of point of personal crisis where I said, okay, either this is something that's worth everything or it's worth nothing. There's no in between. If what we say we believe is true, then it's worth everything. And if it's not true, then what's the point of spending a life living in these religious confines? So I began a journey at that stage where I kind of reasoned that I had several generations of people who had given up everything several times and migrated around the world because of their religious faith. They were pacifists. They didn't want to fight in wars. That would often be what would cause them to move onto a new country because whatever country they're in, we're trying to conscript them into these battles. And they felt like they were a kingdom, not of this world. Governments do what governments do. They've got to protect their people and so on and so forth. But, you know, we live in a higher order and, you know, therefore we don't believe that it's right for us to participate in war. We'll be medics and other things. And I had family that were like medics and things like that in World War II. So they moved around the world because of this faith they had. And I thought, well, certainly if they were willing to do all of that, there must be something to it. I didn't know what, but there must be something there worth exploring. And I started this period where I said, okay, before I decide to just step out and make my way in the world and just have fun with life, I'm going to give all this a try and see if there's anything real to it. So that kind of disillusionment led to a sort of intention that I made at the time of, I'm going to give this a try. And if I can find something real here, I'm going to give everything to it. So I started a period for several weeks where I would just lock myself away in my room and I would just start praying and meditating and just waiting for something to show itself. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to find it, but I just knew I had to find something. And so it was like several weeks of this where I hit, I guess what you would describe as this sort of transcendental state, but I hit this experience where I just felt this incredible ecstatic joy come over me. There's a practice that they do in some of the church, which is kind of how it unfolded for me. It's a terrible name. They call it being slain in the spirit for some reason. I don't know if they came up with that, but I almost consider it more of a somatic exercise. It's really an exercise of just sort of surrendering your body physically to whatever spirit experience you're having spiritually. And it sort of helps you to open up to that. And so that's what kind of happened. I sort of fell down and I was just in this state for, I don't know how long, but I woke up from it and I was like, wow, this is the most amazing thing I've ever experienced. And I was at the time working a part-time job after school in this huge factory in our area. And my job was basically to be the janitor and clean all the toilets. So there was something like, you know, 200 men there and I'd have to go in and clean the toilets every day. It was the most disgusting job, but I was so enjoying this experience I was having as I go to school every day. And I couldn't wait to get there after school every day and shut the door. I'd lock the door out so nobody could come in and I'd have a couple hours cleaning bathrooms without being disturbed. And that whole time, I'm just experiencing this transcendental joy. So that went on for several weeks. And then I had somebody on campus approach me and ask me for some advice, just very random out of the blue. And so I started opening up about this experience that I was having. And he got really interested. And this was, you imagine, a Mennonite school. There were a few kids there that belonged to local families who sent their kids there because they knew it was a good school. So he wasn't a Mennonite. And he was kind of known as a school troublemaker. I told him about the whole experience and I said, you know, do you want to try this? And I had no idea if it would work, but I said, I'll let you try it. So he said, yeah, sure. So we went in the school chapel and I kind of prayed for him and he fell down and had the exact same experience that I had. And he woke up and went, this sort of look of like, what on earth just happened to me? He was in a complete daze and he goes, this is amazing. He says, wait here. And he runs out the chapel and he comes back about 10 minutes later with this girl who was like the toughest girl in the whole school. She actually bullied all the boys. She beat up boys in the school. She was just very, very hard. She came from a really difficult upbringing. And he brought her in. He's like, do it for her. And now I'm like, oh no, this is scary. This doesn't work. She's going to beat me up. So I very nervously put my hands on her and I explained what I was doing and did the whole thing. And the same thing happened to her. But in the process, she broke and just started weeping and just crying. And she got up and then they're like, okay, let's meet here after school. And then they started bringing all of their friends who were basically all the school rebels. And before we knew it, we were having these meetings every night at my house where we were having these experiences. And then spontaneously out of that, somebody just got healed. I think it was like an ear thing or something like that. And they were excited and we were all kind of a bit shocked. And this went on for several weeks. And then summer came. And then, of course, everybody was going off to college in various places. I was a senior. So the whole thing sort of fizzled out at that stage. But it really was the start of an awakening for me that there was something more to this life. And I had to find out what that was. And of course, this sort of made me a black sheep amongst the Mennonite community because, you know, they were just horrified that all of this was going on and, you know, this devil work or whatever it was. So I wasn't very popular in my community when I left, but I spent a year working with a inner city Christian organization dealing with gangs and stuff like that in Fresno because there's a lot of gang stuff there and sort of did that volunteer. And then afterwards, I went and joined a Bible college in Hawaii. So I had this vision that I was going to be doing some sort of a Christian ministry, teaching, healing work, that sort of thing. And this was a place that was sort of open to that stuff. So I got to Hawaii and had some pretty challenging experiences. I mean, in a positive way, challenging my ego and my commitment to what I was doing and so on and so forth. And I was coming off the back of an experience in Fresno, where I'm from, where I had started attending this church there. And they had this youth pastor that I absolutely idolized. And shortly before I finished school, it came out that he was doing some inappropriate things with one of the girls in the youth group. I think she was overage. She was 18, but still it was incredibly inappropriate and so forth. And so he was overnight fired and moved away. And it really shook me because I just thought that this guy was the closest thing to Jesus that I had met. So that was kind of really weighing on me when I was in Hawaii because I just thought, I don't want to end up like that. I don't want to have some sort of a gift and get carried away with that and so forth. And then someday end up like him because I've not developed the character to contain that. So that was kind of the second stage of somewhat of disillusionment with the trappings of success and worried that success would become too much for me. And I sort of had this feeling of, I want to know that I'm doing what I'm meant to be doing in this world. So I made an intentive prayer to say, okay, God, whatever you have for me in this life, I want it. I want to live the fullness of whatever I'm here to do, but I don't want you to release me into that until I'm ready. I wanted to make sure that I had the foundation before that. And so I expected that, you know, it would be sort of a couple years of training and development, and then I'd start on my way. And then it was just like at that stage, my whole life just took a turn for the worse. And it just felt like everything started falling apart, going wrong, to the point that I ended up marrying somebody that I met there who's from Scotland. She got pregnant within a few months of us getting married. I had to drop out of Bible college to look after her. We moved to the north of Scotland where I had like 5 days of sunshine a year. I mean, I literally one year I could count on one hand how many days of sunshine I had. And this is for a kid from California. You know, I'd come from this fairly comfortable middle-class American upbringing, and we show up there, there's no money. I struggled to find work. I eventually found a job in a restaurant working double shifts, trying to look after this baby that was coming. So we had no options, so we, you know, for anywhere to stay, and we went to the local government council office, and they have a homelessness division, and we went in and said, we need a house. Can you give us something? So they took us to this apartment. You get one choice. They give you one option. And then if you don't take it, well, you're in a hostel or sleeping rough in a car. So they take us to this apartment and I show up and it was just horrific. This woman who lived there for the better part of her life, chain smoking and died in the apartment. So all of the ceiling and the walls were just covered in years and years of cigarette tar. And she'd had carpets, which had just been put down roughly with carpet staples. So the council had come in and just ripped the carpets up. but they hadn't removed all the staples. So you imagine the floor was just filled with almost thousands of razor sharp spikes. And I'm thinking, I'm about to bring an infant into this house and I can't even put it on the floor. And it was just awful in this area. I went to work and told people where we were living and they're like, no, you can't be living there. I was like, why? They're like, well, that's little Bosnia. Cause that was during the Bosnia war. And it was like, this was just seen as a war zone locally. So we worked and kind of made the best of that place and scrubbed walls and pulled up these needles from the floor and kind of made our best out of it. But there were times where we'd come home in the evening and there was blood all over our door because somebody had been shooting up under our light. The lawn right in front of our apartment was just riddled with hypodermic needles. We had to pull probably about 40 or 50 out of there. And, you know, we have people pounding on the windows at night. And I mean, it's just on and on. It was just absolutely one of the darkest experiences of my life. And I was seriously in that dark night of the soul. I felt like completely abandoned by God. I felt like, God, where are you? I've given my life to you and this is where you put me and so on and so forth. So we finally managed to find a better house in a better part of town. And this is where the story almost gets better. We move out of there and it was the private landlord who was going abroad for a year. And I knew we were just on the edge financially of what we could afford. And she had done a deal for us on the rent. And I said, okay, if we rent this from you, and we were doing each other a favor because she didn't want to give up her house if she moved away. So I said, we rent this from you. We need to know we've got a minimum of a year to be able to live here because hopefully by that stage, I'd be financially better off. But any less than that, we'd be in dire straits. So she agreed, minimum of a year. It was a handshake agreement. She went off, decided 6 months later that she didn't want to be abroad anymore, and she was coming home, and she wanted her house back immediately. But this happened to happen right over Christmas. And we had just broken up work from Christmas, but just before Christmas, I basically got let go from my company because they were in financial difficulty. And my wife was 6 months pregnant again at the time with our second. So it was Christmas time. Nobody was hiring. There were no jobs available at the time. We had no income. We had no savings. And we were just being kicked out of our house again. So we went back to the council office and asked them for another apartment. And they took us out. Again, one option. They took us out to this neighborhood. I later on found out was where they put all the pedophiles. And now I've got a young daughter. I've got another one on the way. And the apartment is the exact same story. It's a rinse and repeat from the first one. We show up. Again, somebody ripped up carpets, thousands of spikes on the floor, just completely awful. It was a total slum area. And Scotland has those. I mean, the drug abuse in North Scotland is just crazy. And I'm looking at this place and I'm just thinking, I cannot do this again. We didn't have an option. And it was just somewhere inside of me. It was my inner voice or what, but I just had this thought come to mind of, I have to believe that life has more for me than this. I didn't know what, I didn't know how, but I just had to believe that there was more in life for me than what we were experiencing. So I turned around to the woman there and I said, I'm sorry, we're not going to take this. And my wife was shocked because she knew we didn't have any options. But I just said, I can't do it. I told her we have to believe there's more for us. So we didn't know where to go. So we begged some friends and they let us stay on their guest room on the floor. And we all happened to also get the flu at the same time. So it was Christmas. We're sleeping on their floor, posing on them with the flu. And I just had nothing, nowhere to go and no ideas of what to do. And so I put out an email to everyone on my contact list and I said, can you please pray for us because we don't have any options. We need somewhere to stay. And I've got this call a few days later from this very proper, well-spoken English woman, Scottish woman actually, saying, but spoke with that kind of accent, saying, Josh, I've heard about your situation. You must come stay with us. So I've forgotten this woman was on my contact list because I only met her briefly about 6 months prior. And she was a very celebrated interior designer in the UK. She did work for all sorts of celebrities and wealthy individuals and so forth. But she and her husband were very close friends of Queen and Prince Philip at the time. And when I say close friends, I mean they came over for dinner every time they were staying in Balmoral and vice versa. They went hunting together. Their kids, Harry and William, grew up swimming in their pond in the front of their house and so on and so forth. And they had this huge Downton Abbey-style manor house on a private estate up in the Highlands of Scotland. And it was just like a whole other world, but it was an hour outside of where we lived. And so she said, we want you to come and stay with us. And I'm protesting because I don't really know them. I don't know how I'm going to live, stay an hour outside of town and find work. So I'm protesting, you know, we can't do that. She wouldn't take no for an answer. She just kept insisting, you're going to come and stay with us. So finally, I said, okay, this woman was a force of nature. I was like, okay, we load up our car. We drive outside an hour out of the city where we lived. And we were within a mile of their house. And it was at night, so middle of winter, so it's dark, pitch black. And we're about a mile from their house, and I blow a tire. So we're stuck on the side of the road, and we're already running late. And I'm just thinking, oh, they're going to be so angry at me. We're keeping them waiting. There probably food's on the table. And I sheepishly called her up, you know, and I'm just thinking, I have to be the most ineffective human being on the face of the planet right now. I can't even put a roof over my family's head. I can't even get them to a place of safety. So I was just completely broken, really, at the time. So I called her up and told her the situation and apologized. We'll get it fixed. We'll be there shortly, all that. And she says, wait right there. She comes flying down the hill in her Audi and gets out with her shawl on and, you know, darling, get in the car, you know, that sort of thing. And load all our stuff in the car, and they take us up the hill, and it's like driving up the hill is the most beautiful sight I'd ever seen, this house glowing up on the hill. And you come inside, and you can imagine being an interior designer. I mean, this house had literally been on the cover of the British version of Better Homes and Gardens, and it was just immaculate, but very sort of traditional Baroque style, I believe. Not Baroque, it was Georgian style. So they take us into the kitchen, and all the food's on the table, you know, pheasant and wine and all that. And we sit down, and I'm apologizing profusely that we're imposing on them and, you know, all of that, and making my assurances we won't be there long, we'll be on my feet, we'll get out, be a couple of weeks. And she says to me, no, you won't. I said, I'm sorry. She goes, no, you're going to be here for 6 months. And I said, sorry, I always get teary when I tell this story. She said, you're going to be here for 6 months, and your baby's going to be born here, and that's that. I said, I don't understand. So she and her husband started telling us the story because she and her husband are very spiritual people, you know, within this sort of Christian faith, but very intuitive. And they had felt 6 months before that God had told them that the first 6 months of the new year, they were not to have anybody stay with them. Now, they were the sort of people that had people staying with them every single weekend. There were always house parties at their house. It was just a very popular place. There was just a revolving door of guests coming in and out of that place. And for 6 months, they didn't know why they weren't supposed to have anybody stay with them.
In other words, they weren't supposed to plan to have anybody stay with them because right. you came, but they weren't supposed yes. to fill the place yeah. up with somebody else.
Yes, exactly. They knew there was a reason for it. They just didn't know what. So they didn't accept any requests from people. They didn't put out any invitations. They cleared their calendar for 6 months. And then she was in the middle of making Christmas dinner for her family, and she had some time while the oven was cooking, and she gets down and sees, she's like, oh, I'll go check my email, which she never does during the holidays. She's very disciplined about separating work and family. But she's like, I'll go check my email. So she checks her email. She sees her inbox and sees my email and said to her husband, Andy, you know, she said, Andy, this is why we weren't supposed to have anybody stay for 6 months. So they said, we know that you're supposed to be here. We've known for 6 months that somebody was supposed to be here. And we don't want you to worry about anything. We don't want you to worry about finding a job. We don't want to worry about food, diapers. We have an account at the shop in the village. We want you to go and help yourself. Just put it on our account. We'll take care of it. And I basically had a 6 month retreat in the Highland of Scotland in this magnificent home. And I was in quite a bit of shell shock at that time for the sort of few years I'd been before, and had 6 months of just decompressing of all of this experience that we had gone through. And it just sort of opened me up to, you know that, yes, life will take care of us. Life has a plan for us. Life has a purpose for us being here. And I can trust in that. And it's interesting, ever since then, I've never struggled for housing. I've lived in the most amazing places well beyond my means ever since. We just have the most wild, interesting opportunities come to us. And you know, even like now where we live in Tahiti, I mean, it's been absolutely incredible. And we're just so blessed and fortunate. And it's just something I've never worried about since that time in my life. I always know there'll be a place for us somewhere. So that's kind of the first part of the story. Maybe take a breath.
Was that disillusionment number one that we just covered?
That was one and two. So the second disillusionment was when I was in Hawaii. And, you know, I became disillusioned with this external measure of what success looked like or had to be.
I see.
Find success in terms of, you know, what my divine purpose was. So that was the second disillusionment. And the third disillusionment was Stepping back to my Bible college days, because that's important to understand here. One of the things that I did when I was in Bible college, it was a modular program. So you do one course for a compressed period of time. And so I did a 9-month course called the School of Biblical Studies, which was an inductive course on the Bible. So the idea was you set aside all preconceptions about what the Bible's saying in terms of the doctrine that you've been taught growing up. And you're taught principles of hermeneutics and how to understand the history around each particular book of the Bible and apply logic and reason to making sound interpretations of what the Bible is actually saying for itself. It's meant to be an approach to letting the Bible speak for itself, but understanding within its context. So every book of the Bible is essentially a letter written by someone to someone for a specific purpose. It has a specific message, a specific idea it's trying to drive home. So to understand, it can't mean anything to us that didn't mean to the original audience. So the principle is, let's understand what it meant to the original audience, and then we can understand what might be applicable to us outside of that, because some of it is cultural, and it was speaking to specific context, specific issues at the time, and wasn't necessarily meant to be interpreted the way we do in the modern day, which is where a lot of modern Christianity derives. It's proof text things, or it takes things very literally and then tries to apply it to our current situation.
Yeah, that's a healthy approach. I wish that certain political factions could do that with the Constitution and the Founding Fathers as well.
Indeed. You know, we should take that approach with anything. You know, I mean, if you opened up somebody else's inbox and started reading through your emails and you're only getting half the conversation, you're liable to draw some pretty strange conclusions without being able to see the entire email thread.
Did you have to study Aramaic and Greek and anything like that?
Ancient Hebrew, I studied bits and pieces here and there, not enough to where I could read it, but right. You'd have to get into a lot of word studies to understand, because so much of it's locked up in figures of speech and metaphor. And that's where it's very commonly misinterpreted, because we take things literally that were meant as a figure of speech to sort of drive home a point. And through the course of the 9 months that I was in this program, we had to read the Bible 5 times and write a paragraph by paragraph commentary on the entire Bible. So it was incredibly intense. You were studying morning till night, but it was also really fascinating because you saw the way, and you studied it chronologically, because the people don't know the Bible's not chronological and how it's ordered thematically. So you have narrative books, you have prophecy books and poetry books and so on and so forth. It's ordered in that way as opposed to in a chronological order. So some books are chronological within their set.
Also, may I ask here, do you believe, as some do, that the Bible is just sort of a small subset of all the potential information that it could have included, and that there are all kinds of things that were either never found or edited out for various political reasons or doctrinaire reasons, so that it's not necessarily as complete as it could have been?
Well, there's certainly indications in what we have that there are scribal changes. Now, some of those might not be as malintended as they were. I mean, some of them might just be they misunderstood something and went, that can't be right. We're just going to change that letter to that. And you also see some differentiations in the manuscripts with some of the, you know, the New Testament books, where some of them have additional portions that were into them that they think were added later. But I think it's an important segue. I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, just to embellish it just a little bit. So for instance, Yogananda in Autobiography of a Yogi argued that reincarnation was edited out of the Bible at the Council of Nicaea or some such thing, and that they didn't do a really thorough job because there are little hints and snippets of it that got left in.
That's really fascinating. And by the way, I loved Autobiography of a Yogi. I thought it was a phenomenal book, and it came along at a very important time in my life. Reincarnation and the Bible is a very interesting topic. There certainly are cases where they believed in it, right? Because they believed that Elijah was going to be reincarnated and, you know, became John the Baptist. Well, some of them believed that that was Elijah, and Jesus said, it alluded that, you know, he was Elijah reincarnated. Elijah was one of the great prophets, by the way, in the Old Testament, for those who don't have that background. And then, for example, Jesus, many believe, was also the priest Melchizedek, King Priest Melchizedek, who was living a second incarnation.
As Jesus.
As Jesus. And Paul talks about, you know, you were a priest, I believe it was Paul, so you were a priest in the order of Melchizedek. And then he talks about how the way that Abraham treated Melchizedek indicated that he believed that he was of a higher level of being. He was essentially a divinity because he made a sacrifice to him, which he wouldn't have done any other way, and brought him an offering. So there's those indications, but then when you look into New Testament history, there's, you know, for example, Origen, who was a very famous New Testament early Christian theologian who was a reincarnationalist. But what I find most fascinating, and this is jumping ahead a little bit in the story, but there were three main sects within Judaism at the time of Christ. There were the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and there was another group, they were a bit more enigmatic, called the Essenes. And the Pharisees were the very staunch traditionalists. They were the right wing of the day, legalists, that kind of thing. And the Sadducees were more this sort of contemporary liberal modernists, and they were kind of nihilists. They didn't really believe there was an afterlife. And they were the ones that kind of ran Israel of the day. And then there was this group called the Essenes. They were a little bit more enigmatic. They were like a mystical group. And they lived in sort of little communes. So they had one in Nazareth. I believe there was one in Mount Carmel, or it was close to Mount Carmel. I know like Mount Carmel was very special to them. They had one in Jerusalem. They had one in Alexandria, I believe, in Egypt. There was one in Egypt somewhere. And then they had one in Qumran, and they kept a library of documents in Qumran, which we now know as the Dead Sea Scrolls. And we know from their writing that they were reincarnationalists. They believed in reincarnation. They also believed that the main priesthood of Israel at the time was apostate.
What does apostate mean?
Oh, apostate, meaning like they lost their way in terms of the truth.
They're just hypocrites or whatever.
Well, there's more than that. It's like false teaching. They didn't believe, for example, that God had ordered all of these animal sacrifices to be committed all the time. They were vegetarians. They didn't eat meat. They didn't kill animals. And they collected works from all over the world, including a lot of works from the East. So a lot of the Buddhist and Hindu texts were found in Qumran. So it wasn't just the ancient Judaic texts that they were reading. I mean, it was everything. They kept a whole library of this stuff.
Nice.
And then when you look at Jesus, Jesus spent time in all the places where they had communes. So he was born in Bethlehem, but grew up in Nazareth, spent time in Jerusalem, spent his boyhood part of it in Egypt when they had to flee. So, you know, these places where they were, he lived, and a lot of his teachings were actually almost word for word out of their teaching. There were a few sort of parables and stuff he told that were just like word for word what the Essenes taught.
What do you make of the theory that he went to India during some of those lost years?
It's fascinating, because the first time I heard that, I was like, oh, that's a bunch of baloney. And then you kind of hear some of the stories about it, and you're like, well, it's an interesting prospect. You know, I mean, there certainly was this whole long period. And, yeah. You know, when you look at his teachings, there's a lot in it that resembles more of an Eastern philosophy.
Like him having come there and all. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Exactly. There's one particular monastery that claims that they call him Iza or something like that. I can't remember what it was, but they claim he was there and they have the records of it and so forth. And yeah, it's a very fascinating story. Whether he went there or whether it's because he was raised within a Essenic community and had the influence and the teaching of it from within the community, there's no doubt that there's an Eastern influence and perspective that he brings, because it was very different than what you read in the Old Testament. And I think there's a reason for that. A couple other things that pointed to Jesus being an Essene, apart from the fact that he taught some of their teachings, was also the fact that a lot of the Essenes were called Nazarites, because there was a sort of Nazarite vow that they took. And then a lot of Jesus' followers were also called Nazarites. So when they say Jesus of Nazareth, it's a double meaning. It was Nazareth because it's where he grew up, but it's also Nazareth because the sort of Nazarite vow, which he didn't follow a Nazarite vow, but he was kind of associated with that group that these Essenes were commonly referred to. And they were very interesting as a group, because they were known for having tremendous psychic or prophetic powers and being readers of the stars. And they foretold to Pontius Pilate that he would rise to power. And that was, they think, the reason why Pilate didn't want to condemn Jesus, was because of the fact that he knew he was part of this group and he had this great admiration for the Essenes. And locally, they were also known as the healers. They're probably how they're most commonly referred to, as healers. They dressed in white, and they were the people you went to when you needed some sort of spiritual, medical, you know, physical healing. It's just an incredibly interesting group of people. And so when you sort of connect all those dots, and the fact that the New Testament mentions the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but doesn't mention the Essenes, just all points to the idea that it was the Essenes that were writing the book. It was the Essenes that were the early followers of Jesus. And he came out of that group, and they weren't putting the spotlight on themselves. They were putting the spotlight on Jesus. And I think that had that sort of influence on him. But yeah, coming back to the original question, they did believe in reincarnation. And I agree, there are hints throughout the Bible that could speak toward there being reincarnation and reincarnation being true and so forth. So yeah, I think that's a fair comment from what Yogananda said.
And just out of curiosity, this is a little off topic maybe, but do you think that the miracles that Jesus was purported to have performed are exaggerations? Or do you think that he was such a great being that he might actually have done those things?
I do believe that those are real. You know, whether or not any of it's been storyfied, I don't know. But, you know, I mean, you have the same stories about some of the yogis in India performing exactly the same things. So if he had trained there, he may have developed those abilities there. He may have developed them within the Asceniya community because they were known for that as well. Myself, I don't put any question on that. But at the same time, if somebody else questions it and feels uncomfortable with it, it doesn't bother me either. I think it's the message that's more important. And so this is where, you know, to your point about, you know, has it been doctored? The way I look at the Bible is the Bible and scripture in general is not the truth. It's an account of the truth. It's like a window upon which we see the truth or can see the truth. And some windows are a bit more clear than others, but no window is perfect. There's always these blemishes and so forth that can slightly obscure the picture when you look at the detail, but when you stand back, you can see the big picture of what it is. And so I tend to think in terms of, you know, if you understand the Bible within its context and you understand the arc of the story and so forth, you get a pretty clear picture of what it's trying to say if you're looking for it. But of course, a lot of people don't read it that way. What a lot of people read it to do is to validate their own beliefs. So, you know, they start picking and choosing, you know, I like this verse because it makes me feel good about what I believe and makes us feel like we're the right ones and they're the wrong ones. And so we have a tendency to want to kind of read our own subjective viewpoint on it and rather than letting it speak for itself and being open to the truth of whatever it is.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the 19th century slaveholders used the Bible to justify slavery.
Yeah. Precisely. Yeah.
And so when you say you got disillusioned with Christianity, it sounds to me like you really appreciate Christianity, but you got disillusioned with the kind of Christianity that you were familiar with, that you had been raised in, and that has perhaps even that tends to predominate today.
Yeah, or maybe I'd nuance that slightly. I'd say that the early followers of Christ didn't call themselves Christians. That was a label that came later. And I think it was a different entity when that came later, because, you know, I think the early followers of Christ, they often call themselves followers of the way or so forth, but they didn't really put a label to themselves. And that's because Jesus, if you read what he was trying to do, he was not trying to start another religion. I believe very much that he was there trying to help them transcend religion. And where I sort of became disillusioned with it is, you know, so to finish the story, I finished that course and I decided I was going to write a book about what I had learned through seeing the whole picture of the Bible. I wanted to sort of be able to string that story together. So I spent another 10 years. This is while I was going through all this stuff in Scotland and all these difficulties. Spent another 10 years doing a sort of much deeper, more reflective journey through the Bible to really try and understand how this story strings together. And how do you make sense of Jesus and what he taught in light of what seems like a very angry God in the Old Testament? How do you reconcile these? And I came out through the end of that period with just a profound awe at the book that is the Bible when I knew it in its context, but at the same time, just a profound disillusionment with Christianity because so much of what was being taught in the pulpits was almost the exact opposite of what Jesus was teaching. And that was really frustrating. And then when you try to have conversations with people, it was just like they just didn't want to know. It's just the walls go up, you know, and it's like, la, 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 you know, it's just like... Don't tell me anything that sort of rocks my view of the world. And I was really struggling with that because it was like Jesus in his context was a liberator. He did things during his time on earth that actually showed that men and women were equal. For example, when he was in Bethel, and there's a whole story about the washing of his feet with the perfume, and it said that Jesus had the women sitting at his feet. Well, that would have been like shock in their time because the sitting at the feet of a rabbi meant that you were a disciple of the rabbi and rabbis didn't have women disciples. So he was showing they have equal place in the kingdom of heaven. And there were just many things like that. And he was trying to set them free from the legalism that religion had brought. And what now has happened in Christianity, at least much of it, is what I call a crypto-legalism. You know, we say, okay, you're not under law, you're under grace, you're free, right, in Christ. But if you really love God, you're not going to do this, you're not going to do that, you're not going to do this. And then you give this whole laundry list of things that you have to do, and you'll be shunned if you violate those rules. But you're under grace. And so it's this sort of secret, this kind of hidden legalism. And Jesus was trying to set them free from all of that. And it's just become the same thing over again. And so that's where I became disillusioned with Christianity, because I became disillusioned with the institution of Christianity, not with Christ. And I really wanted to know more, and I wanted to grow beyond where I had gone in my spiritual walk at the time. And so I remember this time where I had completed this book, and I was contemplating what to do, really feeling out of place in the church. I hadn't left at the time, but I was very much on the fringe. And I was introduced to a gentleman in Vancouver Island. He was an older guy. He was like in his late 60s at the time, who was just one of the most enlightened beings I've ever met. And he has a similar background to me in that he came out of a Pentecostal church movement, left that, started traveling the world on a spiritual truth quest, ended up in India, spent a lot of time there at the feet of various gurus, and just and learned, and was just so open and just so vast in his knowledge. And we would start talking on the phone every night. We'd speak for hours and hours. And he was just opening my mind in incredible ways. And what's interesting is a lot of the stuff that I had come to understand about Christ was aligning with what he had said. And he told me about, you know, Autobiography of a Yogi and so forth. And then it fascinated me when I read some of what the Indian writers had written about Jesus. It was like, yeah, this is the stuff I found out, but it's the stuff I've never been taught in the church. And so we would talk on the phone every night, and I was sort of more and more opening up to thought outside of the Christian space. And I remember at one point, you know, I was really wrestling, because at the one time, you know, on the one hand, like, you know, leaving the comfort zone of what I had grown up in the Christian faith and generations of that, to step out of that and open up completely, fully, spiritually, it was scary. David Wick was his name. He said, Josh, he said, what are you worried about? Don't you think your father's big enough to get you where you need to go? And it was just like something in me just kind of let go at that stage. And I ended up going out for a walk in the forest. And this was at a period where, again, you know, I was becoming disillusioned with Christianity. My marriage at the time was hitting the wall. That was coming apart at the seams. And I was disillusioned with life, because, I mean, even though we had done better with housing, like, it was just nothing that I envisioned for what I was going to do in life worked out. Everything I tried failed, and I could just never seem to really make any progress in life. And I was just done with everything. I just felt so fed up with life. And I was like, I don't feel like I necessarily want to live anymore. I didn't want to kill myself. I had kids, all that. It wasn't like I was suicidal, but I also just didn't feel like life had any appeal to me anymore. And so I went out and took a walk in the forest, because we lived in a forest there. And I just took a walk, and it was along this river. And as I'm walking, it was just like that sort of giving up thing just turned to complete silence in my mind. And I all of a sudden just, I felt like that sort of self-identity started falling away. And the way I describe it is, it felt like that scene out of Avatar where they first step into the world and they see the whole thing glowing and all that sort of stuff. And it was just like I was seeing the world completely differently, and everything felt alive. And I could feel it. And it's just like you could just feel this interplay of connectedness amongst everything. And I felt the most profound peace I'd ever experienced in my life. There was nothing to fight for or struggle for, anything like that. And I came back just a completely changed person from that. And from then on, just knowing everything's fine. Everything's good. I don't need to worry. And so that's where I started my journey, slowly progressing out of institutional Christianity and expanding my, you know, spiritual horizons, so to speak, and growing in this idea of, you know, I guess what you call no-mindedness and so forth, you know. And then so I started reading Autobiography of a Yogi, and gosh, so many books through both Taoism and Buddhism and Hinduism and all of that. I was just absorbing it all. I think one of my favorites was the Vinda Gita. It's one of the most beautiful books writings I've ever come across.
The what Gita?
The Vinda Gita.
Vinda Gita. I haven't heard of that.
It's a portion, I'm going to slaughter the pronunciation on this. It's a portion of an ancient Indian text called the Tripura. I can look it
Rahasya?
Up. Yeah, Tripura Rahasya. And the Vinda Gita is a portion of it. It's where all the gods are inquiring about ultimate wisdom, and then wisdom herself shows up. And what it says about being is just phenomenal.
Nice.
Yeah.
And you went to India, right?
I did. Yeah, I spent time there. So I was there about 3 months. I had a friend who was from Punjab, so we spent a while, you know, going around Punjab together and had a phenomenal time. And it was amazing to visit. Went to Amritsar as well, which is an incredible place.
The Sikh temple, Golden Temple.
Yes. Yeah, right. The Golden Temple. Yeah.
And so how did you transition from all that into advising companies on how to find transcendent purpose and working with the leaders of Fortune 500 companies and things like that? Keeping in mind that we want to budget our time because we have some cool stuff yet to cover.
From there, I left Scotland shortly after that because my wife and I separated. I was thinking about coming back to the U.S., but I didn't want to be that far away from my I had two daughters that were still there. So I had an opportunity to come up in London, and I would travel back and forth between London and Scotland to see my daughters or bring them down. So I was involved with that company for a few years, and then that came to an end, and I was not sure where to go next. And I was really fascinated at that time about the idea that companies can have a transcendent purpose. And I think it was at that time that somebody introduced me to that TED talk by Simon Sinek about Start With Why, which I thought was really interesting about, you know, building organizations around the idea of why you exist rather than what you do. For those of you who haven't seen it, it's worth a watch on TED. I think it's the most watched TED talk of all time. So I was really fascinated by that idea, but I didn't know where you would start to work with that. And I read his book at the time, and it didn't really offer anything more in depth on how do you build an organization around why. And I searched a load online. I was trying to find different books that might have some answers to that. And no one did. I think there was a sort of assumption that if a leader has their why, then the organization will also have a why. But I felt like there had to be more than that. And so I started looking. I thought, well, maybe I can come up with an analogy for this. I can find some way I can develop my own model around this and something I could test out. And then it was that point I came across another talk, another message. It was given by somebody in India who was asked to be the spiritual advisor for one of the largest corporations in India and to develop the spiritual life of the organization. I thought, oh, this is interesting. You know, let's see what he has to say. And I expected that he would say, you know, so we set up meditation rooms and all of the offices, and we, you know, had retreats and all of that. And he said something really interesting. He said, we started looking at the myths, values, and rituals of the organization. And I was like, hang on a second, I didn't expect that. And then I started thinking about it, and I was like, you know, I spent my whole life immersed in religion and theology. And what if religion is nothing more than a belief system to help us find connection and build a common shared sense of purpose? And what if through that I can find an analogy for how you build an organization on purpose? So I began almost kind of reverse engineering how belief systems work. Looked at religions, I looked at political systems, so on and so forth. And you start to see some common themes that arise through belief systems. It was just as the guy said, there's sort of three pillars of a belief system. You have your myth. You know, myth doesn't mean a fable. It's you know, come to colloquially mean that, but it means the kind of story of your origin, the story that you ascribe to your origin. And that story helps us as a people answer the question, why do we matter? Because it's through that story of origins where we see, okay, this is how we came to be. This is the reason why we're here on this planet. So that connects people emotionally because we share the same story. We have the same core idea about why we're here. And out of that, then you develop your values, and your values are then, okay, what matters to us? So this is why we matter to the planet. And these are the things that matter to us. And then beyond the values, then they develop. So those exist in the heart of the belief system. And then the intellect of the belief system is the ideology, the set of principles and beliefs that you ascribe to. So they also develop these set of principles or ideas that help us think alike. This is how we think the world works. So you move from the why question to the how question. This is how we think the world works, how we think the world should work. And so that connects us on an emotional level and an intellectual level. But then there's the third level, which is the physical level. And so what they do is they take these ideas and they intentionalize them by creating a set of habits and practices that are related symbolically to whatever these ideas are, so that you have a way of somatically putting into exercise what you believe. And so it becomes something that engages you on all three levels. And that's why they're so powerful. They can be powerful use for good, and they can also be a powerful use for evil. It's a very powerful tool, but it's something that we all live with, whether or not we're conscious of it. we all have some sort of an internal belief system within us about why we think we're on this planet, what our values are, and habits that we formed around our life because of what we value. Sometimes those habits are positive, sometimes they're toxic, depending on our values and so to speak. So there's a sort of framework for how we live and operate as humans. And this is because it enabled us as people to move beyond living in tribes. So before we develop belief systems, Yuval Harari talks about this, before we develop belief systems, the largest that a human group could get to would be about 140, and then they would break off and they would start another tribe. And that had to do with something called Dunbar's principle, which was that when you're in a group of people, you know, let's say you're a group of 12 people, understanding all the relationship dynamics is not just knowing 12 relationships. It's actually knowing about 144 because it's 12 times 12. Say you get to 140 people and, you know, the exponential of that would, I don't know, I'm not a mathematician, but it's a large number of relationships that you have to keep track of to know who's doing what and who can you trust, who can't you trust, and so on and so forth. So civilizations struggle, or tribes struggle to grow beyond that until they develop storytelling and then belief systems that enabled us to feel that we had a shared commonality between us, even if I don't really know you. You
It'd be about 20,000 relationships. I just pulled up the calculator.
Yeah. That's a lot of relationship dynamics to manage. So belief systems are what have enabled us to develop as a species, both for good or for bad. So I see them as the belief system itself, not as inherently right or wrong. It's what you plug into that belief system that determines if it's good or bad and if it's toxic or healthy. So I started using that, you know, very openly as a model for developing corporate identity that was holistic. Because when I would go in and consult with companies, you know, I would ask them, you know, I'd go through and we'd sit down and say, what's your story? Why are you here on Earth? What are you here to do that's more than just making profit? And I sort of take this model of the difference between sort of the money being the purpose versus the reward. So a carpenter's purpose is not to make money. A carpenter's purpose is to serve through carpentry. The reward that he gets from serving and bringing value to others is the profit that he makes. So, you know, in the same way, we confuse this idea that a business should exist for profit. No, a business should exist to bring value to the world in some way that's beneficial to humanity. The reward they get for that is making profit. The more value they're bringing, the more profit they make.
So it seems like some businesses, if they were to find a transcendent purpose, would have to either shut down or completely change what they do, like a tobacco company, I think, and many others that I could think that are just essentially harmful to people.
Yeah, and it's funny because I spoke to a guy who was one of the legal counsel to Monsanto. This is at a conference I was invited to speak at. And, you know, I asked him about like the ethics of what they do. And it was just amazing the sort of gymnastics he was doing, you know,
yeah.
Ethically. I won't say what, you know, what he said, but it was quite humorous.
Yeah,
and I fully agree that. Like, I think, you know, there are a lot of companies that are sort of more leeching off of the planet. They're leeching off our resources, they're leeching off our health and welfare, you know, and on and on. I mean, there's a lot of companies like that. Yeah. It doesn't need to be that way. And I'm fortunate enough to work in a place that doesn't see the world that way.
Yeah. Now you're working in a place, the world's number one private island, according to Google, which is also considered to be the world's most sustainable resort. You're located on a private atoll, which is one of Polynesia's most sacred assets. Did I hear you say that Marlon Brando used to own the island?
Yeah, it's true. It was his private atoll. It's not just an island, it's 12 of them. And he came to French Polynesia to shoot Mutiny on the Bounty in the late 50s. And it was where he kind of had a bit of a spiritual awakening. I wouldn't say he was awakened by any stretch. But, you know, he came out of Hollywood at that time. It was interesting, Marlon never wanted to be famous. That was never his goal. And he kind of resented the fame that went with it. He took his trade very seriously, but he never had a sight set on that. So he came here looking for respite and discovered Polynesia and discovered spirituality through Polynesia and discovered this atoll through that period, which for the Polynesians had been seen for, you know, the better part of 1,000 years as a place of renewal and regeneration. So in their lore, if you die here, your soul goes there to be regenerated and then come back again. And there's an incredible, what they call mana or energy on this place, which Marlon saw in it, and he fell in love with it. So he wanted it to be preserved for the generations to come, but he also wanted it to be a place that would inspire people to find a way to live more harmoniously and sustainably with their world. And so what has come today wasn't built by him. It was built by some hotelier that he'd become friends with here locally. But they conceived it together, and it was built to the letter of his wishes. So yeah, it's a very special place. It's, you know, it sometimes gets a reputation of being a bit of a sort of A-list celeb haunt, but it's not really about that. It's a very, you know, when you go, it's very sort of down to earth, a very kind of natural human experience. And you're just immersed in Polynesian culture and in this natural environment of paradise that is extraordinary. I mean, there's only one of the 12 islands has been developed. The others are being kept as a private nature reserve. And so you go there, you're just immersed in unbelievable paradise. And so it's a really special place to be. But its kind of purpose in life is to, number one, model what sustainable hospitality could look like that works in partnership with community. And it works in balance with the ecosystem. And so it models that and then also educates people on what's possible when they come. And it's what's caused an explosion of eco-resorts around the world that have essentially tried to model what they've done here, because it was the first to really do that at the sort of level that it's done. So like Leonardo DiCaprio started developing his project down in Belize, and because he was inspired by this. So it's a very special place to, you know, be a part of.
Nice. You mentioned working with a woman who is leading Polynesian cultural expert and has advised Disney on the Mona film projects, and that you said that she has interesting spiritual insights on how the Polynesian worldview may provide an antidote to the Western imbalance.
Yes.
Is that just kind of what you were just saying in terms of being in tune with nature, or is there something more to that?
Yeah, I can dive a little bit deeper on that. In the West, and Hinano, by the way, is a phenomenal individual. She was a former teacher, so she has all the academic side, but she's also very spiritually attuned. So she brings that side, and she can comfortably work in both sides without a problem. So her story was that when John Lasseter came over, they were looking to develop Disney Moana. He came to Moorea, which is a neighboring island where she lived, and he was introduced to her and asked her to be an advisor on the film for Disney's animated Moana. And he told her she cost them millions of dollars in the end because she made him change so much. It had a profound effect on the country because they were losing their language. The kids didn't want to speak their local Tahitian language anymore. And one of her stipulations when she did it was that she wanted them to make a version in Tahitian for the local kids. And so they did that. She didn't think they would. They did it. They sent 1,000 DVDs, which they sent to all the schools, and all the kids saw it for the first time in their own language. And then they said that for like weeks after, the kids would be running through the streets singing all the Moana songs in Tahitian.
Dubbed in Tahitian? It's the same film, but it's dubbed in Tahitian?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's all animated films are dubbed, so.
Of course, yes.
So she pulled together a group, and they got in a sound studio, and they did all the overdubs and singing and so forth.
Nice.
So it's very special. So they've asked her to come back and advise on the second one. So coming to your question about the Polynesian culture and what it teaches us, I often wonder if some of this is attributed to climate, right? We come from a temperate climate where life can be tough at times, you know, especially the further to the poles that you get. And we have this sort of idea that to live well, to live meaningfully means to succeed in life, right? It's to further and develop your resources so that you can look after your family and bring value to your community and so forth, right? So it's all about the value you're bringing to others, which is then translated in the capitalistic society of more, 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 right? And the Tahitians have come from very small islands that are closed ecosystems where you don't have to grow fruit. It grows on its own and the seas replenish themselves. But you can quickly come to a place where if you overuse your resources, you can end up in a famine.
Like Easter Island.
Easter Island, exactly. Cut down all the trees and then they get marooned and they can't grow fruit and so on and so forth. So they're consciously aware when they're young of how delicate our ecosystem is and the importance of keeping things in balance. So they developed a process called rehui, which is when things become too over-harvested or fished, they will declare a rehui where they will put a restriction, a taboo on, say, fishing in that lagoon. And they do that by sticking these palm fronds up in the sand vertically and along the beach. And then you know that area is rehui. They take it so seriously that if you violate a rehui, it's capital punishment.
They kill you?
Not nowadays, right?
Now, oh, okay.
historically, if you violated a Rihui, it's capital punishment. If you violated another tribe's Rihui, it was an act of war. So this was the most important thing to them. So from a value standpoint, they have a perspective that the most important thing for us to do is to learn to live in harmony with our world. And that means, of course, our families, our community. It means our land, but it also means the ancestors and the gods. Their entire life is from the perspective of how do I find and maintain harmony with everything around me? And so they have that perspective on the world rather than the give me more perspective.
It'd be nice if that could be somehow implemented on a wider scale. As it is now, you have huge Chinese factory ships just parked off the coast of South America, you know, just decimating the fish population. And there's not much anybody can do about it.
There are people trying to bring that concept to the wider world in different ways. And it definitely needs that. I mean, we're part of what we do through the nonprofit here is actually trying to bring restrictions on things that affect the ocean, like overfishing. And in our case, what we're most concerned about is seabed mining, because these companies are going to go and basically just tear up the seabed a mile below the surface where nobody can see what they're doing and potentially destroy, you know, the ocean ecosystem.
Yeah, they found that they can get lithium out of all these little rocks on the seabed, which they can use to make electric car batteries.
Correct. Yes. So it's a huge concern. For not just for them, but for native peoples around the world who, you know, have communities that thrive on the sea.
And interesting.
The ocean is actually alive. The ocean is a living entity, and therefore it has rights. So that's their approach, is to try and get the nations to ascribe to the rights of the ocean, because it should be treated as a living entity, not just as an inanimate resource that we can use for whatever we want.
As should the whole world.
Yes.
Well, the whole thing's a living entity.
Yes, it is.
It's tricky because, you know, like in the case of the seabed, getting all that lithium would be great in terms of making more electric cars, which would have a nice impact on the environment. But even now, there's environmental devastation and unfair labor practices and all to get the kinds of minerals they need to make electric cars. So it's hard, I suppose, to find a balance between compassion and environmental sustainability and getting the resources we need to transition to a different technological framework.
Yeah, and I think it's going to happen on two fronts. I mean, technology will help, but we also have to change how we view and live with the world and perhaps not be as materialistic and be content with less. Find inner contentment rather than chasing outer contentment. You know, I think it's not one or the other, it's both and.
Yeah.
But particularly with the question of the lithium, the batteries, we published a white paper here. Basically, it was picked up by one of the journals that we won't need lithium. It's going to be very soon obsolete because they have new methods for making batteries.
I heard there's a sodium alternative that might work.
I don't remember what the alternative was, but the technology is here. It's not something that is possible. They have the technology. And it's easier for these companies to keep pumping lithium out of the ground because that's what their business model is than to switch to a new business model. So there is that factor as well.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, that could be a whole nother conversation. So we've talked about disillusionment and how the constructive influence that played in your life. And perhaps we could shift it a little bit to societal disillusion and generational disillusionment. You mentioned some of that in your notes, that it's terrifying for people, but it's the only way in which we can find our freedom from illusion and be awakened to our higher self-consciousness. I'm reading your notes. Without facing disillusionment, we end up caught between the ego self and the higher self, trying to escape something or attain something, spiritual escapism. When we face illusion and let it go, we find the truth that is always there. You mentioned you struggle to find anyone who's gone through great spiritual growth and awakening that hasn't at some point reached the state of disillusionment with the world. And then you go on to talk about generations Z and Y, because they're collectively disillusioned these days. And you said some interesting things about that, so perhaps we could talk about that.
I've spent some time recently talking to a lot of Gen Zers about what are the questions they have, what are they looking for in life, and just trying to really understand the generations and where things are going. And the answers that I've had back have been really surprising and somewhat encouraging. A lot of the ones that I've spoken to, they are looking for some sort of meaning in life, but they're looking for meaningful work that's in balance with life. They don't have the same capitalist drive that the previous generations did. I've had questions about how to get out of hookup culture. A lot of them are very disillusioned with hookup culture that's been going on.
What is hookup culture? Like transitory, trivial, romantic relationships? Is that what that means?
Yeah, one night stands.
That kind of thing. Sure.
Yeah. So there seems to be a lot of disillusionment with that. And they want to know if there's hope for the world, because a lot of them feel very hopeless. Mm-hmm. And they see a lot of that driven by governments and by big corp. And they don't want to play the game anymore. You know, I say sort of Gen X, you know, we started getting disillusioned with it, but we were a small generation. So we just made some really good rock and roll about it. Gen Y became a little bit more idealistic and thought they could sort of bring change from within the inside. But Gen Z are, I think, very disillusioned with the world and very uncertain about the future and not wanting to play the game anymore. And they're big enough to matter.
What age brackets are these? I never get those things straight. All I can remember is the baby boomers, because I am one. What do the XYZs represent?
So I think X went from the boomers up until just after 75, 76.
People who were born 75, 76. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was born 76. So I'm just at the start of the Gen X. But then they say, just to confuse it further, there's a sort of 10-year span that sort of like the last 5 years of Gen X and the first 5 years of Gen Y that they call the Xennials, X-ennials, because they were sort of caught in between both, because we were young enough that we adopted technology at a young age, but still also remembered the time before technology. So that's why they call us, they say we're sort of a kind of oddball in the generational mix. So then you have Gen Y, which goes up until almost the millennium, or I think until the millennium, because my oldest daughter was late millennial. She was 98. And then you have from there until, I think it's about 15 or so, I think, are the Gen Z. And then you have the alpha generation coming up.
Now, of course, a lot of young people go through a phase like this. And then people like Abby Hoffman, Reggie Davis, or whatever his name was, end up becoming stockbrokers or something. It doesn't always last.
Well, that was very true of your generation, right?
Yeah. But I think it's a good phase of life if one can really latch onto it and set one's life in that direction. And if the whole generation can do it, the whole culture could change.
The way I look at it, though, is that your generation, Rick, played an important part in starting the wake-up process. And then that sort of took time to mature until where we are now, whereas I think that this generation has the potential to further that. It's not going to be on their own. I mean, I think it's going to be helped by some pretty interesting circumstances we're going to find ourselves in the next few years, where a lot of our structures are really shaking up.
I think that too.
My feeling, and it's just a feeling, that, you know, we're going to see a lot of our power structures really shaken. And I think during that process, we're going to see a polarization, because I think we're going to see people either running forward into technology and transhumanism and the virtual world. And then you're going to see a reversion of a bunch of people who are going to be trying to skate back to traditionalism. So you see, even now, you see guys like Andrew Tate and, you know, these sort of machismo, masculine misogyny sort of making a resurgence. And you also see women. There's this whole trad wife movement where women are sort of basically kind of returning to like 1950s housewife. So you have that on one hand, and then also political revisionism. And I think some people will be piling back into religion, looking for some sort of comfort there. But the thing is that those structures, I don't think, fit the world that we're destined for. And it will take some disruption before we're able to get to that world. And so I think in the middle, there's going to be a sort of third wave of people that are attuned and conscious, and they're seeing the world that's to come, and they're excited about it.
Yeah, I interviewed a guy named Dwayne Elgin a couple of times. And in my second interview with him, he showed this little graphic. I think we actually had a little video. He feels that sort of three possible scenarios, in each of which everything is going to pretty much collapse. But then Number one was it stays collapsed for a long time, just chaos. Number two is some kind of Chinese-style technological autocracy gets imposed. And number three is out of the collapse, there's a spiritual renaissance and we have a bright new age, as many ancient traditions have prophesied.
Yeah, and I'm hoping it's the latter. You know, I have a sense that's where we're going. Because I'm also encouraged by the fact that spirituality is growing amongst millennials and Gen Z. They're interested in it. They're looking for the answers. And so I have hope that, you know, we are going that way. But it's birth pangs. It's going to be a process.
Yeah. And you say, I expect to see the unfolding world events as a polarizing force that will either drive people toward their spiritual path through disillusionment, or they will double down on the material world, afraid to let go of the illusion. I sometimes, when I think about that, I think of the analogy of a rising tide lifts all boats, which is fine for the boats if they don't happen to be anchored. But if they insist on remaining anchored, they're going to capsize.
That's a great analogy. Time to draw your anchors up.
Yeah. And I wonder about that, because I would like to see huge changes. I think we need huge changes. But I hate the thought that a lot of people are going to suffer in the process or through that transition.
I agree. I know it's going to be a trying period. And I think a lot of the suffering is going to be fear driven, which is the worst suffering. The fear and the terror, you know, when bad things go wrong. I mean, you saw that in COVID, right? I mean, the fear of COVID was worse than the reactions that caused as a result was worse than, you know, the pandemic itself.
Yeah.
And not say it wasn't bad. My father almost passed away with COVID, so I know it can be bad, but our reaction to it made things worse. But at the same time, we know that there's life beyond all of this. And this is something I think the seers have looked toward for generations and generations.
Yeah, some good stuff in your notes here. The dissolution of the world's power structures, which will give humanity an opportunity to transcend ego-based living into a form of life that is aligned to higher self and our divine potential. So I guess we're seeing the dissolution. Well, there's the disillusion, but there's also the dissolution, the dissolving of the world's power structures. I sometimes wonder, you know, there are some very powerful structures in this world, political, economic, technological, and so on, which, you know, it's a David and Goliath kind of a situation. How can the so-called spiritual people, if they are going to be instrumental in any kind of transformation, go up against these powerful things and prevail? But David won, I believe, because God was on his side. I hate to use that phrase because, you know, that's used for football games and things. But he had a larger destiny and power behind him that enabled him to prevail. So I sometimes think that if God wills it, to put it in those kinds of terms, if God wills that there's going to be a huge global societal transformation, nothing will be able to stop it. Because that power we're talking about is far more powerful than any mundane power.
I completely agree. And I like how you put that. I think we're not leading this.
Right.
We're supporting it. And I think if this is happening as we suspect it is, there will be other forces at work, which we'll be supporting from this, you know, maybe not sort of from the sidelines, but, you know, we'll be supporting through being there and helping to ease the suffering on the planet and helping to bring people to peace and joy and awakening.
Yeah.
And I think these things will create a hunger for that. And it's going to be a joy to participate in that side of things.
There's a great story from the Indian scriptures where there was this huge deluge, rain and rain and rain, and the village where Krishna lived was getting inundated, and the people appealed to Krishna, who was supposed to be an avatar of God, please save us, you know. So Krishna just picked up a mountain and held it up, you know, over the village like an umbrella and saved the people from the water. But then they thought, well, it's an awfully big mountain and he might strain his wrist or something. So they all picked up sticks to help hold up the mountain. And of course, their sticks weren't really doing anything. He was the one who was holding it up, but they felt like they were helping. So that's kind of an illustration of what you just said.
I love it. We're here to be the witness, you know, and that's what people need, is a witness to the truth. But yeah, I like that analogy. This is great.
Okay, now feel free. I'm starting to talk a little bit more than I was throughout the interview, and I don't want to dominate. So we're talking about dissolution of the world's power structures as a necessary function of a transition to a very different world, which I think many of us idealistically and hopefully not naively expect to have happen. Whether or not it happens in our lifetimes, I don't know. Then here's a cool one that you mentioned. We are transcending world religions into one true spiritual religion, which has no name. Jerusalem and Babylon are actually archetypes of this. And of course, everyone has heard the term spiritual, but not religious, where people like you and I, we respect all the different religions. We don't feel like any one of them is the true one or any such thing. And perhaps we are harbingers of the kind of spiritual religion you're talking about, where it's an appreciation of a universal truth. When I run up against religious fundamentalists, there's this Amish guy that used to come to the farmer's market, and I would sit down and start talking astronomy with him and try to give him an idea of how large the universe is. When I think of spirituality, I think of it on that scale, the whole universe. Yeah. Certainly not the exclusive province of even one planet, much less one particular religion on a planet.
Yes, yes. I think that's it's a nice picture. I guess how I relate to that, first of all, I think having a belief system is useful only as far as it's useful. There was a passage in the New Testament where Jesus healed this man on the Sabbath, and they were up in arms. And the reason they were is it was probably one of the most sacred laws in all Judaism, is keeping the Sabbath, because it was a symbol of their covenant relationship with God.
Yeah, these days they won't even switch a light switch on. It's too much work.
Yeah, well, yeah, Orthodox Jews won't. Yeah, that's right, exactly. They treated it very seriously because of the symbolic nature. And when they asked Jesus about it, he said, well, man was not made for the Sabbath, but Sabbath for man. By extension, man was not made for religion, but religion for man. So I have this perspective of religion. Paul called it, best translation, the teacher, the tutor. So he referred to Judaism as a tutor that brought him to the place where then he could step into Christ, which was the spiritual universal consciousness, the logos. And so I kind of view it that way, in terms of I don't look back with horror and hatred on the time that I had in Christianity. I see it as the school ground that helped me along to where I was able to step into real spirituality. It's really important, because when we are in school, when we're young, we're living in a construct of reality that's scaled down. It's not the real world, right? It's a sort of microcosm of it, in a way that allows us to learn. And, you know, when kids are playing, they're practicing and being grown-ups, right? They play with cars, or they play with kitchens and whatever else, and practicing what it's going to mean to be a grown-up. At some point, they get to the point where they need to graduate school, and being there any longer feels like they're in a prison. They just can't wait to get out of school. Let me free. And that's that difference between religion and spirituality, or what you could say is the true religion, which isn't any earthly religion. It's a whole spiritual fabric of reality, is that understanding that it serves a purpose. There are places you could go to in the world today where if you just walked in and said, well, let's eradicate religion as it is, they descend into utter moral chaos.
Yeah, good point. They need that.
Right. They haven't developed the moral compass to the point where you take away the fear factor and they go, okay, well, I'm going to be kind to my neighbor because it's good for the world. They would go, well, you know, what's good for me is good for me, and I'll take your cows and your wife and your whatever else that I want. Yeah. Those places still exist, and they existed even more so back in the time that the Bible was written. So it still serves a purpose, and I just tend to look at it as people on a different stage of their journey. At some point, they'll run dry, and they'll be looking for something beyond it. And that's, I think, what we're seeing with a lot of religions, you know, around a lot of people who were religious around the world that are saying, okay, I need something more real, more tangible than this.
Yeah, that's good. A lot of examples I can think of, such as training wheels on a bicycle, which are real useful when you're just learning to ride, but they get in your way after you've learned. Or yes. Taoism talks, Tao Te Ching talks about how the higher the level of consciousness that predominates in a society, the less rules and the less government it actually needs, because people spontaneously abide with they flow with the Tao, you know, and they abide by what is. And Hinduism and probably Buddhism also have similar points. Hinduism talks about the yugas, different ages, and it's in our yuga, which they say is the darkest age, that you need the most structures, because people aren't spontaneously behaving rightly.
That's really interesting. I had a very vivid analogy of this. When my daughter was young, she was about 7 years old. And from when she was born, I thought, you know, the main thing I want to teach them in life is how to love other people. I don't want to put a sort of pressure on her to be anything or do anything. I just want her to love others. And so she was young. I was trying to teach her, I want you to love your sister and love the people around you. And I kept trying to teach her this, and she just wasn't getting it. And at one point, she was being really ornery with her sister and her, and I got really annoyed with her. And I was like, you know what? Damn it. We had rules when I was a kid. We're going to have rules in our house now. So I went to the internet, found somewhere online a set of rules, and I printed them off. And I went and put them on a refrigerator door, and I marched my daughter over to it. And I said, okay, here's the rules of the house. It was very simple things. Don't hurt others. Don't hurt your sister. Don't take from others. Don't steal from others. Don't, you know, on and on, you know. And just very simple rules, graduated down to her level. So she's looking at these rules and she just sits there quietly for a minute. And she looks at me and she goes, "You mean that if I follow these rules, you won't be angry with me?" And I go, "Yeah." And then I'm like, I'm starting to feel really bad because I'm like, where am I as a father? This is her response. And then she gets this big smile on her face. And I'm feeling even worse. And I'm like, I realize in her mind, when I say, okay, love your sister, she has no idea what that means. She hasn't developed the mental capacity to understand what does it mean, the wisdom to love my sister or my parents or whatever. So to her, I was like this big bear all the time where I was just randomly getting angry at her because she'd done something. And she's like, well, what have I done? And it just gave me this whole perspective on the Old Testament because, you know, when the Hebrew slaves came out of Egypt, they were illiterate and they were raised as slaves. So if you're raised as a slave, you're not taught how to do anything for yourself. You're not taught how to make decisions. You're not taught how to make any decisions at all, let alone run a community, let alone build a country. So these illiterate slaves come out of Egypt, which is probably one of the most well-ordered countries on the planet at the time, and they come into the wilderness without the foggiest idea of what they're going to do. They've been slaves their entire life. And so they would have had the mental perspective of the world of a child, no education, completely illiterate. So then when you read the story of the Old Testament through their eyes, it's like the story of an angry father telling a child off. And I remember when I was, you know, my dad would tell me off as a kid, I thought a couple of times he was going to kill me. Of course, you know, you grow up later and you realize that wasn't the case. But in your five-year-old mind, you're like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to live the rest of the afternoon, you know. Make him sound really bad. It wasn't. It was just that you have that perspective as a kid where your parents can be really scary at times and unpredictable. So when you look at Judaism from that standpoint, and this is a very exoteric religion, it wasn't like the Eastern philosophies, which were very internalized, is very much about the inner journey. It was about building and modeling community and what a positive community looks like. And if you look at all of the laws that were made within that context, there was almost all of them, you can find some sort of reason or rationale why those laws were given. They made some sort of sense from a communal standpoint. So what you do with a child when you raise a child is you start out giving them a set of rules that protect them, and they show them what love looks like. They aren't love itself, but you hope that through them practicing the rules and you building the discipline within them, over time, they're going to start to get a picture of what love looks like. And at some point when they're older, that will translate into actually loving people. When they start having the practice of showing love and seeing the effect it has on others around them, that begins to inspire them to live a life that is loving toward others. The whole Old Testament, all the laws were built on this idea of do no harm. In the Old Testament, it worked in a forbidden, permissive legal mindset. They had a covenant legal relationship with God. By the way, all the stuff about God pouring his wrath out on Jesus and all of that, you know, to punish him for all of our sins was a complete misunderstanding of what the whole affair was about with the cross and what that meant. Because the Jews had a covenant mindset. They had a legal agreement with God that said, you and I are one. It's the same as a marriage covenant, right? The two become one. Us as a nation and you are one. Somebody does something to us, they're doing it to you and vice versa. So they had this sort of perspective. So it was always prophesied in the Old Testament that when the Messiah would come, the law would be written on their hearts. That's the transition from the school ground to spirituality, because it becomes in the heart. So when you read Paul's writing, he makes it very clear. He said five times, five key books of the Bible, he said, all things are lawful unto me, not all things are beneficial. Paul worked from a harmful, beneficial standpoint, not a forbidden, permissive standpoint. And that was what he's trying to teach the churches. So all of Paul's writing in the churches were contextual instruction addressing specific issues at the time to say, this is how love should look like in your community. He was not writing a law that said every Christian from now on should do this. He was trying to train them up and teach them how to have the wisdom of love and how to live as a loving community. And that's the thing that's very often misunderstood about him. It was written to a very specific group of people. Now, you can learn from it by understanding why he was doing it, but it was never meant to be literally applied to our present day.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about Ken Wilber's work. I don't know if you've ever read any of him. And there's also a thing called spiral dynamics, in which they have all these colors. I always forget what the different colors represent, but it kind of sketches out the kinds of things we're discussing about the various levels of psychological and emotional maturity that humans go through and societies go through, and yes. You know, how they tend to view the world based on any particular level of maturity and what kind of society you have to have, what kind of religions you're going to have if a certain level of maturity predominates.
Yes.
Interesting stuff. You also might want to watch my interview with Father Sean O'Leary, who argued that there's no archaeological evidence that there were ever any Jewish slaves in Egypt or in the desert for 40 years. He claims the whole thing was a myth, but I can't get into that whole argument.
I tell you what, I'll watch that interview, but look up a guy on YouTube called Robert Feather. He was a metallurgist. One of the Dead Sea Scrolls is called the Copper Scroll, and he was asked to review it. And he found out it was like something like 99.99% pure copper, which he said would have been impossible to do at the time.
And the scroll was made of copper?
Scroll was made of copper. And he was an atheist at the time, and he became really fascinated by the scroll. How do these ancient people manage to do this at the time when they didn't have the technology? So he started studying the Dead Sea Scrolls, and there's one of the scrolls called the Temple Scroll, which describes the building of this new temple, the rebuilding of the temple. But the dimensions of the temple do not fit on the mountain in Jerusalem. It's too big. And they've never been able to work out why. The scholars, you know, why was this temple so much bigger than the Jerusalem Mount? And so he's reading about this, and he reads this word in there of Akhenaten. And he says, what is this? And he asked one of his esteemed colleagues, you know, he's an expert in that. He said, what is this? And he said, well, that was a pharaoh in Egypt. I believe it was Nefertiti's father. So he started looking up this pharaoh in Egypt, and he found this pharaoh existed, and they found they had a whole city and a temple mount that matched perfectly with this scroll. And they've uncovered this. Essentially, he brought monotheism to Egypt for a short period, and he got rid of the polytheism. And he had this group of slaves that were there through that period, and he traces the whole story of how they went from, these were the Proto-Hebrew slaves, and he's got evidence for that, traces them into the wilderness and actually finds the tabernacle mount that's listed in the Bible, which is in a completely different place than what is traditionally believed.
Okay.
And this is all on the YouTube thing. So have a watch. It's really interesting.
I'll check it out. I'll connect you with Sean O'Leary. You guys can duke it out. Then you also said an interesting thing here about how we were about to transcend worldly government into a spiritual government that is guided by spirit rather than legislation and penalty, which is kind of along the lines we've been speaking. But again, when you actually try to conceive of the changes that would have to take place in the governments of the world in order for that to come about in a meaningful way, you can't imagine how those changes would take place. I mean, it's all we can do to get some piece of legislation through the Congress these days.
Yes. I mean, I think where we're going, it's hard to imagine what it's going to be like at all. We're going somewhere we've never been before.
I hope we are. I'm not like these Gen whatevers who are all disillusioned. I have a lot of optimism, but I can't conceive of the actual mechanics that will have to be undergone for us to get from here to there in terms of, you know, how governments, because everything seems so recalcitrant, you know, so resistant to change, so stodgy. Everything's kind of locked in. Not only in our country, but many countries. So how does it happen?
I think it's going to happen at grassroots level. I think what we're going to see is governments fragmenting, where we've had a lot of superpowers before. I think we're going to see those superpowers diminish and become more fragmented. And I think within that, you'll find spaces that almost might become a little bit more self-governing and feudal in terms of how they operate. And it's not to say they won't be a part of any larger government, but I think we'll see those governments weakened to the point where you'll have some places that will be incredible and they will really express what community looks like. And I think you have other places that won't be so much. You know, I don't see this as being an immediate overnight thing, but I think we will see a transition as these structures shake. We will see a transition toward that. But, you know, I have no idea how and how long that's going to take to happen.
Yeah, it could take a while, but who knows? The pace of change seems to be increasing exponentially. And now with AI, that's another major accelerator.
Yes.
As the internet was, but even more so now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's accelerating at a scary pace. It may be kind of the why now sort of thing, because if that continues at that pace, the amount of self-destruction that we could do would be wild. I mean, it'd be incredible. I mean, not incredible in a good way. I mean, vast. It could become very dangerous. And, you know, even guys like Elon Musk have stood up and said, this stuff's dangerous. So when you guys like that, who are very cutting edge on the technology, you take it seriously.
Well, you're in a pretty safe place. You can just eat fish and collect rainwater.
Yeah. Climb a tree and get some mangoes, you know.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so we've covered a lot here. What haven't we covered that you want to make sure that, you know, we touch upon before we conclude?
I'd like to actually talk about what made me come to see Christ in a more universalist light.
Okay.
Richard Rohr touched on this, and I thought what he said was great.
You mean in my interview with him? Or
yes, interview with him. Yeah, he talked about how Christ is not Jesus' last name. It was a title. It was a function. And it's a function that's incredibly rich with symbolism that we don't get. The first Christ was King Solomon in Jewish history. The first had that title. It was a king, almost king priestly type role. And the word literally means anointing, the anointed one. And when you sort of break down the symbolism of what anointing means is where it sort of starts to open up this concept and what it means. So the anointing oil that they used in Israel at the time, there were different elements that were used in the temple worship, including olives, which they make oil for the lamps, spices they use for the bread, incense they used on the fire, and they would crush it together to make, they call it oud in the Middle East, but like an oil fragrance, cologne, perfume sort of thing that smelled amazing. It's very symbolic of spiritual awakening because, you know, you put a fragrance on and then you go walk out in the world and then you walk past somebody and all of a sudden they get a whiff of it and they're awakened to this thing. And so there's this symbolism, this idea that the work of the Christ is to create unity, create oneness, where the oil is a symbol of taking separate bitter elements and crushing them together so they become one pleasant substance.
And here, when you say the Christ, you mean like the cosmic consciousness or something, not just Jesus of Nazareth, right?
So yeah, so Christ is essentially, it's the cosmic consciousness.
Right, right.
It's the I am.
Yes, right? Okay.
But the idea that that consciousness would dwell on earth through men and it would have an effect of bringing oneness on the planet. So where we take all of these separate substances, crush them together, bitter, they come together, the beautiful fragrance is what happens when men are brought together into oneness. So in the Jewish mind, the Messiah, of course, they didn't see it on quite a cosmic level. They saw the Messiah as being the sort of godly, almost priest-king who was going to create unity between the people of Israel and going to create unity between them and God so that they would be in one and they would have peace. Because they had this history before the kings arrived of just being constantly wiped out by their neighbors. They build up again and they get wiped out and they build up again and get wiped out. And they wanted peace. And it was a peace would come through the Messiah who would unite them together in peace. Because before that, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That's what it said in the Judges. So they had this view that ultimately there would be the ultimate Messiah that would come that they were looking toward. And which, of course, Christians believe is Jesus that would do this job once and for all. So when you have this idea of the anointing oil and this sort of creation of oneness, what's really interesting is when Jesus is at the Last Supper with his disciples, what he says in John, he says, I and the Father are one. You're one with me, you are one with the Father. And this whole talk there was about the oneness that they had together and that he was bringing. And there's this beautiful verse in the Psalms that said how good, how pleasant it is when brethren dwell together in unity. It is like oil flowing down the beard of Aaron. Aaron was the first high priest. So that's the picture, right? It's that anointing that just unifies everything. And in the temples, they take this oil and everything was touched by the same substance to show that it was all sanctified as it was all one. So you have Jesus of the Last Supper with his disciples talking about how they are one with him. He is one with the Father. No one has seen the Father because the Father can't be seen, at least in this material form. And he leaves the Last Supper to go out to the Garden of Gethsemane to spend the night praying and interceding for his disciples because he knows what he's about to go through. The word Gethsemane in Hebrew means the olive press. So his soul was being crushed on their behalf that night. And as he was praying that they would be one through that. And so this whole idea about what Christ means and what it stands for is oneness as a very simple purest essence. And it's the bringing together of everything into oneness. As Paul said, the summing up of all things in Christ. So this is the idea. And Jesus was, of course, the incarnation of that, but it's the concept stands much bigger than that moment in time. It's really the logos, the uncarved block of, you almost say it's like the uncarved block of the Tao Te Ching walking amongst us as a human to show what it looks like to be in a perfect state of peace. So I don't know if that makes sense to you at all.
Yes, it does. Kind of related to what you've been saying about the history of the Jews and so on, how they kept getting wiped out and all. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or insights about the Middle East situation as it now stands. If we appoint you Prime Minister of Israel tomorrow, what are you going to do?
I don't think that'd be a job I would want, nor many other. It's such a sticky situation there because there are so many conflicting interests there that go beyond just two religions warring. If you could get people together and you could get them to share, you could cross that divide. And there's a great story. I think it was Adam Sandler when he filmed Zohan, I think. In the story, they had some Jews and they had some Palestinians, and they're sort of at each other's throats. And they spoke about behind the scenes, because they used Jewish and Palestinian actors. When they started the film, they hated each other and they were always arguing with each other. They'd sit down for meals and just be arguing the whole time through. But by the end of it, as they had taken time to hear each other's sides, they started to understand one another, and they actually finished the shoot as like best friends. That's what needs to happen there and in any other place of conflict. But it's going to be hard when you have other interests that don't like the idea of resolving these things because conflict is beneficial for them in some way or another. Yeah.
Yeah, there's this fellow named Thomas Hubel that I've interviewed a couple of times, and his specialty seems to be generational trauma. He's German, his wife is Israeli, and he's done a lot over the trauma of the Holocaust and the lasting impression that has made in the collective psyches of Germans and Jews and so on. And I think he's been applying it to other contexts as well. But there's a huge amount of that in the Arab-Israeli situation. Because I think of collective consciousness, just as we individually have our psychologies and our mentalities, and we can accumulate grievances and biases and all that. I think that entire cultures do that. And just as it might take a fair amount of therapy or catharsis of some kind for us to cleanse ourselves individually of those qualities, the same is true of societies. And lacking that, failing to do that, we end up with wars because this stuff just builds up to a breaking point like static electricity and clouds. Eventually lightning has to strike. But if there could be ways of defusing it before it had to break out as wars by actually really having some deep fundamental transformational technologies for entire societies and cultures, as well as individuals, then perhaps that would be part of the mechanism of transitioning to the kind of more enlightened world that you and I have contemplated in this conversation.
It's really interesting because the Mennonite community, one of the things I'm really grateful for about my upbringing was experiencing community like the Mennonites had it. Kind of answering this in a bit of a roundabout way. You lived in a place where you didn't lock your door. You didn't worry about walking down the street. Everybody was there to help one another. They built very, very strong communities to the point that even in, there's a very traditional one in Belize right now that's actually growing. Even though they're so traditional, they're actually having people coming from Mexico and Belize saying, can we join your community? Because they're so inspired by seeing real community in action. And they had this very interesting perspective. They saw themselves as a kingdom, not of this world. So they saw themselves already as part of a higher order. And their motto was the Bible and the plow, which meant that they felt like the way that you express your spirituality is through your work. So they wanted to build and model, almost to be like this island. They wanted to build and model what real community looks like, a real spiritual community looks like, so that they could inspire other people to live the same way. And they did. They were so effective with their agricultural that Catherine the Great came to visit them in the Ukraine during her time to understand how they could be so effective with their agriculture. But they were just very hard workers who modeled what community looked like. And you knew growing up that you had to be a part of this community and you had to fit in with this community and participate and bring value to it and so forth. And I see that as a lot of the antidote to where we are, because part of the problem with all of the mental health issues and everything that we're going through is we were never meant to be people that lived the way we're living. Isolated individuals, we were meant to grow up and live in community. And in Polynesia, they still practice that. The village raises the child and everybody's uncle and aunt. Single mothers is not even remotely an issue here. It's like the woman gets pregnant, has a baby, well, auntie and granny and whoever else looks at it, and she goes off and she's still a young woman, has a life, and she comes home to her baby. And because the whole family, the whole village is raising the child, and they have this very close, connected sense that you realize doesn't exist elsewhere in the world. Where I sort of bridge the divide of the East and the West is, you know, the East has been very much focused on the inner journey. And it's fascinating. You go to India where there's just so much spiritual pursuit and insight, and yet, you know, people won't even sweep their own front door sometimes. Or you go to the opposite end where you have very exoteric religions that have been very focused on the external of trying to force community, force countries to live and behave in a certain way. But they've been very much focused on the outward expression of what spirituality should look like. And it's not an either or. I think the only way we can fully express ourselves spiritually is within community. You know, it's how we're meant to function. And I think that's going to be what I hope is the next stage for us in terms of spiritual awakening is we'll be awakening, but awakening into community. I think there'll be a hunger more and more for people to say, I don't want to live isolated on my own anymore. I want to live with other people where we can share this life together and share in love and compassion and so forth. That's what I'm kind of looking forward to. I think we'll see those happen organically in different places, and I think we'll see those grow. And as people see it, they become the lights, you know, the city on a hill. You know, it's that sort of concept where it starts to slowly change minds and perspectives of what life can and should look like on this planet.
At the end of the Rig Veda, there's this verse, parts of which are, know your minds to be functioning together from a common source. That's one phrase. And another phrase is, an assembly is significant in unity. And I think both of those indicate that essentially we are all unified. But like these islands that are around you, they're actually all one landmass, but you only see the tips of them because of the water. So, you know, we're all essentially one collective consciousness, but we seem much more individuated than we are ultimately.
Yeah, and at some point, we'll start to emerge as a more connected landmass, maybe.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah,
I like that. Nice analogy.
Right, which kind of points to the notion that ultimately the solution to the world's problems is not political or economic or technological, or even though all those things need to be considered and transformed, but ultimately the solution is the source from which everything derives its nourishment, which is the God or deep inner spirit or our essential nature or whatever you want to call it. If we can all, a lot of us, get in tune with that, then I think things will tend to sort themselves out on the surface in ways that we can't foresee.
Yeah, I think, you know, the principles, we don't overthrow, we supplant.
Yeah, you know? Nice.
So that was essentially what the Bible taught. The way was not to try and topple the system that's there, it was to supplant it with something better.
Yeah, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
Precisely.
So you don't have much of a social media presence or a website or anything else, but is there any way in which, if people get inspired by this conversation, they can interact with you in any way, or you just prefer to remain a private person and you just wanted to have a conversation?
I appreciate it. I felt like I should stick some content out for people to have it. So I've started slowly putting some stuff on YouTube, a little bit on Instagram and TikTok, although it remains to be seen if TikTok will be around in 6 months' time.
Maybe it will be in Polynesia.
Yeah, maybe. So I think I sent you a link, like a link tree that has all those, but I can send you those separate links to all.
Yeah, send them separately just to be safe, to make sure I get them, and I'll put them up on your BatGet page.
That would be great. Appreciate that.
So. Okay, great. Well, thanks, Josh. Appreciate spending the time with you. Sorry I couldn't make it out to Tahiti to do this in person.
Part two will be in person.
Yeah, right. All righty.
I really enjoyed the conversation today.
Yeah, me too. Very stimulating. And thanks to those who've been listening and or watching. So we'll see you for the next one.